Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, acclaimed mystery writer Sarah Paretsky discusses her new book, Pay Dirt, the latest installment of her iconic V.I. Warshawski detective series. Paretsky is joined by Booklist editor Donna Seaman. The following conversation originally took place April 16th, 2024, and was recorded live at the American Writers Museum.
Hello, everybody. How are we doing tonight? Good, good. Thank you for coming out. I'm Kerry Cranston. I'm the president here at the American Writers Museum. And lastly, don't forget to join us next month for the Free American Writers Festival held at Harold Washington Library on May 19th. This brings together more than five dozen writers to talk about their craft, as well as activities and experiences for all ages. We'll have five different stages, and it will be an all-day affair. So come join us on May 19th. We want to thank you all for being here and celebrating the past, present, and future of American writing. Now, for our program, when Victoria Iphigenia Warshawski first drove south along Lake Michigan in a humid Chicago July in Sarah Paretsky's Indemnity Only, women in crime novels were wives, girlfriends, or victims. Femme fatales, window dressing, or a conveniently deceased motivation for a male character. Paretsky's 1982 book changed all of that. Her private eye, cool under fire, unflinchingly brave, became a model many would imitate, but none would surpass. 22 novels after the first indelible appearance, Warshawski finds herself in Kansas, investigating a case with roots that go back to the American Civil War, plunging the reader into a conflict that is splitting today's schools, libraries, and legislatures into warring camps. How do we address the history of race in the United States? Sarah Paretsky is only one of only four living writers to have received both the Grand Master Award and the Mystery Writers of America and the Cartier Diamond Dagger from the Crime Writers Association of Great Britain. She'll be interviewed tonight by Booklist adult books editor Donna Seaman, author of Identity Unknown and member of the American Writers Museum content leadership team. Please join me in welcoming them both.
Thank you so much, Kerry. It's always wonderful to be here in the museum. Thanks for coming out on a rainy night. It's great to see so many people, and thank you everyone out there online. Sarah, congratulations on Pay Dirt.
Thank you so much, Donna. It was a lot of work in the making, so it's good to be here to celebrate it with you.
Well, there's so much to talk about. It's a very incredibly complicated, provocative novel. I'm really impressed by the plotting. We'll talk about that. But let's begin with why you sent Vic away from Chicago, back to Lawrence, Kansas, a place you have some connection to.
I grew up in Lawrence, Kansas, and I don't know why, but as I've gotten older, I've lived in Chicago for almost 60 years now, but as I've gotten older, Kansas calls to me from time to time. I've set four novels partially there, but this one was completely there. And without trying to describe the plot in a lot of detail, at least not right now, it has to do with property. And in Chicago, if you're trying to trace who owns a piece of property over time, things get torn down, things get built up, things get hidden. This happens everywhere, but it's a lot harder to track down, not just in any urban landscape, but in an urban landscape that is notorious for its corruption payoffs, dead bodies hidden under various trucks and tractors. And in Kansas, people are no more virtuous than they are in Chicago, believe me, but there are fewer of them, and so it's harder for them to hide.
So, Vic comes to Kansas with her sort of goddaughter, Bernie, who's an athlete, she's a hockey player. So this novel just came out. Perhaps you've been watching the NAAC women's basketball, right? So how does this novel begin?
So this novel begins because I looked into my crystal ball when I was four. When we just moved to Kansas, my older brother, who was the brilliant one, was tormenting me, and I told him that I was a witch and witches knew everything. And this unnerved him. He ran to our mother and he said, "Sarah says she knows everything. She doesn't really, does she?" But I guess my early witchdom
I think so.
gave me these prescient qualities, because one of V.I.'s proteges plays NCAA basketball at Northwestern, and she's about to break the 3,000 point scoring mark, which, you know, is nothing for Caitlin Clark, but it's still, there are only like 12 or 14 women in the history of women's basketball who've hit that 3,000 mark. So VI goes down with Angela and with their roommates to watch her break this scoring mark. Okay, so who in this room shopped at Women and Children First when Ann Christopherson was still? So we are all 2 degrees of separation from Tara Vanderveer, the winningest coach in basketball, who just stepped down from coaching at women at Stanford, because Ann's sister Jane played with Tara at the University of Indiana. They were teammates. And so all of us who shopped at Women and Children are close to helping these young women turn into the athletes that they are today.
I love that. But of course, this is a crime novel. So happy as they were about their basketball victory, as soon as VI ends up in the parking lot, things change. And you introduce one of the very intriguing Kansas characters, a social studies teacher who is kind of confronted by an angry father. And yes. I wonder if you talk about that a little bit. It's an important part of the...
Katie Perrick is someone who taught junior high in Lawrence in the previous novel that I sent VI down to Kansas for. And she's moved to an ex-urban school district. And she gets fired by the school board because they think that her curriculum is too woke for their children. It's possible that she would have just been let off with a reprimand, but there's a guy named Trigg. Oh, it's kind of hard to explain. I did my undergraduate work at KU, and then I was a graduate student at the University of Chicago. And both campuses, there were just people who could not leave school behind. Right. And they were kind of sad characters. And one of them in particular in Lawrence was always going around in a big old army jacket, and he had wild curly hair that he never combed. And he just started inhabiting Trigg Garrity, poor Trigg. So Trigg is one of these people who is protesting everything. And when VI encounters him in this parking lot after the basketball game, he's putting a bumper sticker on an SUV that says, "I'm changing the environment, ask me how." Remember those from about 20 years ago? There were urban gorillas who would tag SUVs. Anyway, so if Trigg had not gone out to protest at this school, the questioning of Katie's curriculum, it's possible that the school board would have just said, okay, don't do it again. But Trigg kind of, wherever he goes, the temperature goes up. And so he got Katie fired, essentially, by kind of going overboard with his protests.
And Katie's, so there's a lot of history here. You know, Sarah, I read your biography, and I'd sort of forgotten that you have a PhD in history, for God's sake.
Well, they only gave me my degree when I promised I wouldn't teach anywhere in the continental United States.
So there's a lot of history in pay dirt. Kansas has incredible story. It's Civil War era, you know, bleeding Kansas and all the fighting over freedom. And Katie's trying to teach young people the truth about indigenous people and black settlers in Kansas. And there's this whole, so as the crimes occur, one of the athletes that was visiting from Chicago disappears, so VI has to go look for her. And she ends up at this house in the woods. I wonder if you could talk about Dutton House, and you know, this sort of starts her on this path about the property you mentioned.
I don't want to say too much about the house because the history of the house is pivotal to actually how the crime gets solved, how the crime unfolds. But it's an old house, little house in the big woods. When we moved to Kansas from upstate New York, my older brother and I did not want to go for a lot of reasons, but one of them was that we learned that there was no good humor truck, and our summers were organized around those fudgesicles at 6:30 every night. My mother, who was a great storyteller herself, said, "Oh, you'll love it. You can see 100 miles in every direction." And we got there, and I'm here to tell you that Kansas is only flat west of the Flint Hills. it was just as hilly as upstate New York. And we were like, you lied to us, it's not flat, we can't see 100 miles. But so it's very hilly, and I invented a hill, I added a hill to the landscape around Lawrence, Kansas. And this house is kind of there, going up the hill and going into the woods. And it's being used, this isn't really a spoiler, this is just annoying. It's being used, there's a local frat boys are raising money by selling fentanyl. And so the house is, the person who currently owns the house, who's got like three extra mortgages on his land, he's renting it out to these boys for their drug parties. And that's where VI finds the missing student and then comes back the next day. Why does she come back the next day? Anyway, she finds a dead woman in the basement. And instead of, you know, this student is close to death, she's had way too many opioids in her system, VI saves her life. But instead of being like, thank you, VI, you saved my daughter, now you can go back to Chicago. No, the mother involves the FBI, they want to accuse VI of selling drugs, then they want to accuse her of killing this woman whose body she finds in the basement. And so, you know, here she is, poor VI, you think Chicago is dangerous, but in Chicago you have friends, you have even people on the police force who are your friends. Some aren't, but some are. You have a network. In Kansas, she has no one. And so she has to wrestle her way through all of this. And I was thinking, if there is one hallmark of my recent books, more than any other, it is that if there is a billionaire, he is a very wicked person.
There is a very wicked billionaire.
And so one of the things, you know, one of the things that's fun as a writer, when I'm wrestling with the plot, and it's kind of like I'm wrestling with two octopuses, but you get these cameos and you can just have so much fun writing about them. So this billionaire who's out in Salina, carefully not making him a billionaire in Wichita, where the Koch brothers hang out, just writing about him and his nasty sons and then his kind of just too chill daughter. It was just so much fun. So wasn't fun for VI. She was handcuffed in the back of a car hurtling across Interstate 80.
She really 70. Put her through it in this book. So VI's, you know, our private eye, but she does find allies. And I was particularly enjoyed a young journalist. And I wonder if you could talk about Zoe a little bit and why. So I feel when you bring this journalist in, VI has journalist friends in Chicago too. And I feel like you're sort of reminding us of how important reporters are and, you know, the quest for truth, that you need different people on the case.
I think the death of local newspapers, both in big markets like Chicago, but especially in small markets, is one of the cause of one of the biggest dangers facing the Republic. People get all of their news from big conglomerates now, or almost all their news from big conglomerates. There's nobody who's actually out there covering like library boards, school boards, all the little board meetings that tell you what's going on in your community. And so you get your library taken over by extremists, or you get your school board taken over by extremists, and nobody knows because nobody's writing about things at the local level. Well, I have this journalist whose parents are here in the room, Zoe Cruikshank. She's 4 years old now, but I know she's going to grow up to be the toughest woman on the planet. And she is someone with a passion for real journalism. She gets paid $12,000 a year, which, as you know, is nothing, for covering all the news in Douglas County, where Lawrence is situated. And when VI shows up and these dead bodies show up, Zoe could not be happier, because this is real news. This is a real story. This is going to get her a national reputation. This is going to allow her to start making $15,000 a year from reporting the news instead of $12,000. No. But I think that there are a ton of journalists who are really committed to reporting and to finding out and to putting their lives on the line in ways that we don't even pay attention to the murder of journalists around the world. And it was just a great opportunity to have a young person with that ardor that journalists all over the world have for finding a story and making the story come to light.
And she's really essential to VI surviving this whole endeavor. There's other heroes, some librarians, which I particularly enjoyed. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, there's a set of diaries from the Civil War era that you create. There's a whole family that you talk about. I wonder if you could talk
well,
about
that. Well, in the course of setting a number of novels in Kansas, you know, I'm just drawn to that history, that bleeding Kansas history. And so I've been doing research. If I live long enough, if I write faster, if I get the courage, I'd like to do a YA novel set in the 1850s in Kansas, but we'll see. So I keep reading the history, keep reading the diaries. And the people who came out, the New England Emigrant Aid Society, who sent anti-slavery settlers to Kansas, the women kept diaries. And you read their diaries, this was not a fun life. They were bone ignorant about how to survive on the prairie, how to build a house. A lot of times the winters would be so bitter and the house would be so, the boards, snow would come in through the boards, rattlesnakes, rats, everything would come in and their feet would freeze. They would have their feet amputated when spring came. But meanwhile, water is like a quarter mile away. They're going to get water to cook, to wash, and so on. Well, they go visiting each other on Sundays, and then they write about, you know, it's like, oh, Mrs. Peretsky did not press her table linens. You know, it's like they're judging each other for the quality of their housekeeping in the middle of this sort of desolation and hardship. And I'm like, oh, I would have been so ostracized.
Me too.
But reading these journals and reading some of the letters home, it just gave me a yearning to create my own characters. And then one of the triggers for writing this book, there was a book called The Agitators, right? I mentioned it at the end and anyway, it's about three women, two white women and Harriet Tubman, who lived together in Auburn, New York. So Henry Seward's wife, Frances, Fanny, and another local woman were much more radically committed to abolition than their husbands were. They fought hard to get the Women's Property Act passed so that they could control their own fortunes. And then they started funding Tubman's Underground Railroad work. And Tubman came and settled in Auburn near these two women, and they were lifelong friends. And I guess I also had a yearning for this brief window in white American history when white women were willing to take a back seat to black women and let them run the anti-slavery societies and just do what was asked of them and move forward with that. And so I wanted to have that presence in my book too. So that's part of the backstory. So I wrote a lot of diaries, I wrote a lot of letters, and then in the end, because this is a crime novel, pace matters, and all these diaries and letters were just slowing down the pace. So I've taken them out, but I hope I'll be able to use them maybe when I write my YA book. I'll do that in my 80s.
Well, yes, talking about pace, I mean, there's so much going on here. There's other plot elements involving the environment and family farms, and I mean, I don't want to give too much away, but this seems like a very challenging novel. This is kind of like a rate on your scale of difficulty, would you say?
I think this was the hardest book I've written. I went back to the beginning 9 times, and some of those, you know, it wasn't always everything from the beginning, but I'd say 4 of those times it was everything from the beginning, because I knew what I wanted the story to do, but I couldn't make it work. And I was I was having events from the 1860s and events from the 2020s, and trying to bring them together in a credible way was just a huge challenge. And then I have VI, who's there. She's a fish out of her native water, trying to deal with all that. And then there are things that, like, homelessness is an issue all over this country. But when I go back to my hometown, I am shocked by the number of homeless people that you see. It's like, if you walk down Michigan Avenue and there was somebody in every doorway from Roosevelt Road to Oak Street, it's on that scale that you see it in smaller towns. And so that became something that I needed to roll in. Can I read a little?
Please do. Yeah, I was just thinking about that scene. I bet you're gonna read. Yeah.
There's
the veteran.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. VI needs to break into, or she wants to. I sometimes get angry letters from, I get a lot of angry letters from readers, but in particular, they're annoyed that VI breaks the law by breaking and entering as much as she does. I'm like, oh. If I knew how to hack into computers, VI would do that instead of physically breaking and entering. So there's a bar called the Lion's Heart that she wants to get into the upper story, into the offices, and just see what's going on. And she shows up, it's the middle of the night, there's still a light showing from the office windows, and so she's just waiting for the lights to go out. As I waited, I began hearing the sounds of the night. Even in town, small animals rustle about. The wind blew papers across the parking lot. Near me, someone was groaning in their sleep. As my eyes adjusted to the dark, I realized that I had invaded a communal bedroom. I saw three people sleeping on the ground near me, including the groaner, but one man was sitting up, watching me. "You a cop?" he asked. "Nope, I'm a robber." "You're in the wrong place if you want to rob anyone. No one here has the price of a night's sleep, or we'd be in a bed somewhere. I could use a drink, though, and a smoke. When I finished my robbery, I'll come back and help you out," I promised, "as long as you don't call the cops on me." He made a sound that might have been a laugh. In the dark, as I waited for the second story light to go out, he ended up telling me his story. 3 tours in Afghanistan, too much anger when he got home, couldn't hold a job, his wife left him taking their child. "Randy's 11 now. Every now and then I get myself shaved and bathed, go see him for a few hours." It was past 4 when Don Wilton came out the back door and drove off. Underneath the bottom of the fire escape, I took the time to ground myself. The bottom rung was almost 3 feet above my head. When I reached my arms up, a stream of pain ran through my triceps. VI, the Caitlin Clark of the detective team, moves through traffic, squats, times her jump, leaps above the guards, whacks her hand on metal but can't grasp it. "Tough it out," I muttered. "You want this body to go back to Chicago alive, you play through the pain. Flex the hands, squat, jump, hold onto a bar. Yes." Biceps trembling, hoisting the weight up, getting a second rung, swinging the feet, finding the wall, bracing myself, scooting crab-like up the wall, and she works the window open. I pushed up the bottom sash, hooked a leg over the sill. "Hey, Spider Woman!" The hoarse voice beneath me startled me so much that I let the sash come down on my butt. "Could have used you climbing up from the irrigation trenches in Kandahar," he called. My vet friend. It was oddly comforting to have his ghostly voice keep me company. Then she's in the office and she does what she's trying to do. And then below me, I heard my vet's hoarse voice calling, "Spider Woman, in a minute," I called back, intent on the audio feed I was listening to. My vet called Spider Woman again, and then another man spoke, the same twang I'd just been listening to on the recording. "What are you doing down here, dirtbag?" "Hey, man, you don't own the sidewalk. I own the building, and you're turning it into an eyesore." There was the ugly sound of someone being kicked, someone crying out, and then footsteps going around to the back of the building. I went to the window, slid out as I'd slid in, closed the sash, climbed down the fire escape, and jumped from the bottom rung. Pain ran up and down my body like voltage through the Yancey pylons. My vet was on his knees, on his side, knees drawn up to his chin, rocking in pain. I crawled over to him. I was holding his hand when a squad car pulled up and shone a spotlight on us. "What are you doing?" "Resting," I said. Wilton heard the bullhorn and hustled around the side of the building, looking from us to the squad. He beetled over to the car, yelling that we were breaking in. "They were breaking into the bar. I caught them in the act." "Oh, please, Don," I said. "You caught my friend here resting against the side of the building. You kicked him so hard he's having trouble getting to his feet. I was walking by. I heard you." Anyway, the cop demanded an ID from me. I dug my driver's license out of a zip pocket in the hoodie. "Oh, the Chicago detective," she said, making Chicago detective sound like pizza peddling pedophile.
Thank you, Sarah. That's a great
Thanks
scene. No, I was thinking about that. Oh, B.I., she's such a toughie, but she really...
No, I mean, right before this scene, she was out at the billionaire where his team beat her up. That's why she's in so much pain. But, oh, V.I., that's why I'm not letting her get older than 50, because, you know...
I wondered about that. Well, so here's another V.I. question. She's supposed to be relaxing in Lawrence. This was supposed to be a break to cheer her up. And I find myself wondering, will she ever find love? It starts out this disaster with Peter and all this stuff.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, I will say that I'm working on a book right now that is not about VI. And she just takes such a beating in pay dirt. I don't know. I was just so low in spirits when I was working on this book that VI just had to be down there in the dumps with me. It was like, that was so unfair.
That explains a lot. Yeah.
And so and now she's getting a reward that I'm not able to share. She's in Sardinia. She's at a spa. Aww. She's getting some serious recuperation. She and Peter are making up.
Okay.
He's an archaeologist. He's working on a dig in Spain. And, you know, I think she's going to go there and they're going to hang out in Malaga for a while together and look at Phoenician ruins. And while I'm here in Chicago struggling with my new book and my new character, which also is not going as smoothly as I would like.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I like that. Can you give us any hints about your new character, or is it top secret?
Well, in a way, it's not the anti-VI, but it's the aging VI. I was in Paris last summer. A friend was turning 70, and he wanted all of us to come and celebrate his birthday, so we did. And I was staying in this hotel, and the bed was like this high off the ground. And as I was sliding out in the morning, I landed on the floor and jolted my already not very good hip. And I thought, gosh, what would VI do if her hip was bugging her? If she was 75 and her hip was bugging her, and she had to jump out a window, and she had to escape bad guys. And in that moment, this character, Lily, came to me. Lily was a CIA agent for many years. She was stationed in a country called Hayalistan, which is Turkish for imaginary country. And then she's in her 70s, and she suddenly gets religion and starts a podcast revealing all the naughty things the CIA was doing while she was working for them. And so they want to kill her. And so the book is about this older woman who has to jump out of windows with her bad hip. Trying to stay one ahead of the CIA. So
that is very promising. I love it.
So I hope I can write it, but I'm having fun thinking about it. And also just, I can see now why it took J.R.R. Tolkien forever to publish the Lord of the Rings books, because you make up this country and there you are, Hayalistan and Mount Mukaddes, the holy mountain that, You know, of course, the country is Islamic because it's there in Central Asia, but the clans, they still have a lot of power, and the women, never mind, I won't tell you about the women.
Oh, we want to hear
but
more.
Anyway, it's so it's just so much fun. It's like being 4 years old and playing with making mud pies in the garden to be making up this country and everything.
So do you enjoy research? I mean, are you reading up on that part of the world, or are you just letting
No, I do enjoy research, and research is such a good way to avoid writing.
Yeah. It's like, it's my favorite part. So that's very exciting. I characterize you as like a social justice crime writer. And when you, like for this book, did you decide you needed to go to Lawrence, or did a bunch of themes come to you and then you thought they need to be in Lawrence? So how did, you know, the concept for this come together?
I think both. So I read this book, The Agitators, about the two Fannies and Harriet Tubman. And then at the same time, I read a really challenging book called This Is Not Dixie by a historian named Brett Campney. And Mr. Campney examined newspapers from all over the state of Kansas for a period of about a century, from 1865 to 1935. He discovered that there was a lynching of an African-American, sometimes an indigenous person, at least once a week somewhere in Kansas. Mm-hmm. And reading this book was very disturbing. And his research has expanded to cover the Midwest, and Kansas was not uniquely awful. But what was uniquely awful, I think, was that this state, where white people suffered and died to bring Kansas free into the Union, then became a really racist place. And in fact, some of this was not a surprise to me, because when we moved there, the town of Lawrence was segregated, schools were segregated. But this level of violence, I had no idea that this had historically been part of this state and the heritage. And so the more I read about the violations, the more I read about seizure of property as well as destruction of life, the more I felt that I needed to write a story that, I don't know, if I'm having a bad time, I want everyone to have a bad time. No, not like that. I guess I feel a little embarrassed saying, you know, I'd say this wasn't exactly a crusade as much as I think I can only write when I feel really passionately about something. And I just had this passionate need to have this story be told. I think crime fiction is the ideal medium for telling tales about social justice, because it's where everything meets. You know, it's life on the streets, it's life in law enforcement, it's the judicial system. And you can spin it any way you want to. You know, you can have your cops be totally good guys who are always doing the right thing, or you can have your people be people who are at the mercy of cops who aren't necessarily doing the right thing. You can have members of the judicial system who are trying to do the right thing, who are overwhelmed by public pressure. There are just 1,000 different ways that you can spin law, justice, and society if you're writing crime fiction, and it's all, you can make it all true and believable and still tell a great story. There was a crime writer, Mexican, and I don't know if he's still alive and still writing. I haven't seen his work in translation lately, but his name is Paco Taibo, T-A-I-B-O. And Paco said that in Mexico, where literature is censored, crime fiction isn't, because it's considered fluff and it's below the radar. And so that's where you tell what's really happening in a society that does not want to acknowledge what's really happening. So to me, you know, my goal is to write a story that people want to read. I don't want to be on a soapbox giving a lecture that no one wants to listen to. So trying to merge those two, and the fun that I have playing with characters and inventing them and the interactions with the need to tell a story that I care passionately about. That's I mean, it's both the challenge and the joy, I guess.
Yeah, that's a really great description of what crime fiction does, the function of crime fiction. How do you feel about the evolution of the genre? I mean, since you started with BI back in the early 1980s.
Yeah, I know.
Rare woman crime writer writing about a woman. And now the things have really, don't you think, changed? Or is this a happy spot in our lives?
Absolutely. And, you know, just like watching Caitlin Clark, you feel really glad that all of the hard work that people did along the way led to that moment. And I feel like, in a way, actually, even though I'm not an athlete myself, I felt so much pride, not just, I mean, not with her, but all those women watching South Carolina, the way they played under the basket. And I just thought, all of us, my generation, all of you here, we helped make that happen because it was our commitment to seeing women have a chance, having things open for them. Maybe it wasn't on the basketball court, but it was wherever we were in our lives, helping open those doors that helped create the momentum that led to that USC Iowa game. And I think we all know that there's a tremendous amount of pushback against women these days, against women's lives, against the valuing women's lives as something more than our eggs. It's a hard time. It's a hard time for everyone. But I also feel like there's so many young people out there now who aren't buying that narrative, and that we've open these floodgates, and it's glorious, I think, to see all of these young people, men and women and in between, coming forward and wanting to do this. So, you know, what I'm doing isn't novel anymore, and that's good. It's good. It would be hard if 40 years in I was still the only person doing this. That would be really sad.
Indeed. You know, talking about that sort of shift in consciousness, I've been so, and when you mentioned reproductive rights and the situation in Arizona where they went back to a law from the Civil War era, and I've been thinking a lot about the Civil War. In fact, when I reviewed your book, I did an accompanying list of crime fiction set in the Civil War. There's some really other very interesting novels, and there's a new movie out about the Civil War, and I'm thinking, you know, so how do you feel about the relevance of that era now at this moment in our lives?
Yeah, I guess I keep reciting the Gettysburg Address. Now we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether this nation or any nation so conceived and so dedicated can endure. I hope we can. I don't know if we will.
What seems important to, I mean, I always really think it's important to look to the past and to read historical fiction, to read history, to, you know, really think about the continuity. And...
Mm. Yep. So what can I say? I try to be optimistic, but I'm also scared. I'm a frightened optimist. Yeah. I mean, you can't live without hope. And so, I don't know, Michael Kundera wrote a piece in the New Yorker years and years ago about a Czech poet whose name I did not write down, and the New Yorker is really hard to search, so I can't find his essay or the name of the poet or anything. But he said this was a man who locked himself in his house and stopped writing poetry because he was so depressed by the Soviet Union's control of Czechoslovakia. And he said, if I came out 300 years from now, it would be the same. And he died, and the following year, the Iron Curtain fell. And I just think it's a really important lesson that you don't give up. You don't give up because you don't know where what you're doing, the push that you're making, the words you're saying, the song you're singing, whatever it is you're doing, you don't know when that will make the crucial difference and the wall will come tumbling down. Yeah. So I have to live with that hope.
Oh, definitely. And I think books are just, you know, I love meaningful fiction. It's sort of smuggling in these truths to people. You know, you were saying you don't want to lecture to people. So, you know, I love novels that make you think, that confront really important facts and do it in a way that you can relate to. So, you know, I think it's tremendous. You have a tremendous impact and influence and make really creative use of it.
Thank you.
Very, very thankful for you.
Thank you very much.
Well, such a wonderful audience. I hope you have questions for Sarah. We have some time for that, and there's microphones will be made available.
If you do have questions, please step over to the mic over there people online can hear. And give me 1 second to unmute it, please, Hill.
Thank you, Chris.
Hi. Sarah, thank you for your time and insightful comments. You've written, I'm going to oversimplify, you've written about a book every 2 years. Could you talk a little bit about how you organize that theoretical 2 years? In other words, how much of it is research? How much of it is your mind outlining what you're going to do, then writing and then editing and et cetera? And just give us an idea of what a normal book time is like.
I would like to write faster and smarter and harder than 2 years. It's not my goal to spend 2 years writing on a book. I write genre fiction. Publishers would like you to do a book a year. They'd like you to do two books a year if you could. I had an editor many years ago, who flew out to Chicago and said they didn't think I was a reliable writer because it took me so long to write my books, but that if I would start putting out two books a year, they would think I was reliable. I was like, whoa! So that was hard lines. Sue Grafton once said, or maybe she said many times, that the only thing you learn from a book that you've written is how to write that book. You don't learn how to write any other books except the one that you just finished writing. And that is so true. Every book starts in a different place for me. Sometimes it starts with a character like Lily, the CIA agent. Sometimes it starts with a location, with pay dirt. It started with this Civil War history. And then the challenge is I've got either the idea of a crime or the idea of a setting, the idea of a character, to build a narrative arc around that. In my earliest books, I was really driven by crimes. And so Bloodshot, my fifth book in the series, dealt with the, never mind, too long a story, but it dealt with some very naughty behavior by the Johns Manville company on hiding the effect of asbestos on the lungs of the miners. And I chose a different industry because I can't get libel and slander insurance. I skate too close to the edge. So I try to be very careful. Anyway, then I had to come up with characters, and then I have characters and I put them in motion, but the motion that they're in, the story isn't working. It's not believable for who they are. So I either have to change the story or change the characters. You know, I get asked a lot, are you a pantser, which I hate. That word just sounds like a merging of a German tank division and Captain Underpants, but it means, do you write by the seat of your pants or do you outline? Well, I think people who can outline are like chess players. They can think many moves ahead, and I can't. I just can't see. If I do this, then this, then this. And so I'm someone who, I think that I'm like a tennis player. I'm like Martina. People are hitting balls at me, and sometimes I can return them, and sometimes they go out of court, and then I have to rethink my strategy and work on my backhand, and you know, so it's more interactive with the characters and with the time, and that's why it takes me so long, because I'm a slow thinker. I'm a fast writer and a slow thinker.
You're a deep thinker.
We have someone in the online audience asking you a question. This might be hard. Do you have a favorite book you've written?
Do I have a favorite among my books? I think the ones where the characters are somehow very personal to me are my favorites. And the third book in the series, Killing Orders, introduces VI's mother, Gabriella, and I gave her my own grandmother's immigrant history. So that one still is very personal to me. I came to Chicago in the summer of 1966 as a volunteer in the civil rights movement. It was the summer that Martin Luther King was here trying to helped the local civil rights leadership move the city on housing and employment. And it was I was assigned to a project on the South Side in Gage Park. And it was a very violent summer, a lot of white riots in reaction to Dr. King's and the rest of the leadership's initiatives. And I had a just front row seat at some of that, at the big Marquette Park riots and so on. So the book that I wrote called Hardball, which is set on that in that summer, is probably my personal favorite because it's the most personal. It's what brought me to Chicago. It's what made me want to live in Chicago. Growing up in rural, I cannot say that word. I grew up in rural Kansas. My parents had a subscription to the New Yorker, and I used to lie on the dusty living room floor looking at all these glamorous people, and I thought, I'm going to be in Paris or London or, failing that, New York. But I think I have a shot in a beer kind of personality, so I ended up in Chicago. My husband used to say that I would go into the ring against anyone as long as he were five times my size.
I think as in these events, usually there are people who would like to write books who maybe haven't. Could you talk about what kind of advice would you give to someone who's thinking about writing a crime novel? What should they do?
I think they should sign up for Lori Rader Day's classes and
snarky. And Sisters in Crime, right?
And Sisters in Crime. So I think the hardest thing about writing a book is having the courage of your vision and sitting down and doing it. Or at least that was my experience. I had the idea that I wanted to write a book with a woman protagonist for 8 years before I actually wrote the book. And it wasn't until Stuart Kaminsky was teaching a night class at Northwestern called Writing Detective Fiction for Publication, and I signed up for it, and Stu was, he was very enthusiastic about my detective and also gave me some really good helpful advice, and I was, he helped me have the confidence to see it through to the end. Now, as Lori was saying, we have Sisters in Crime and the Midwest chapter of Mystery Writers of America. Both organizations are open to people who are trying to write, wanting to write, needing more advice, more support on how to write, and especially Sisters does a phenomenal job with that. So all you have to do, if this is in your heart and mind but not quite on your page, is to go to sistersincrime.org, .org, and find your local chapter. There's also an online chapter, and you will find yourself with a very supportive community helping you make that next step.
Can you talk a little bit about how the earlier book about murder in Kansas might have shaped or influenced the VI books that go into Kansas?
Some of it had to do with setting. And when I have to feel the setting physically. It takes a while to shift from Chicago to some other setting. I'm enjoying creating Hialistan because it can be whatever I want it to be. But if I'm writing about a real place, I have to see that place and feel it. I'm not good at just reading a book about it. Stuart Kaminsky, who helped me with my first novel, he had a series set in the Soviet Union long before the wall came down, set in Moscow. And for political reasons, he was never allowed a visa to visit the country. But he studied that city. He knew the subway system, the metro. He knew everything about it, so much so that when the wall fell or the Soviet Union collapsed and he was finally able to go, the mayor of Moscow gave him a key to the city and a personal tour, because he said he didn't think anyone had ever written about Moscow as vividly and realistically as Stu had. And I really admire that, but I have to feel the location. And so going back to Kansas and walking the prairie, and prairies have a particular kind of beauty that you don't see when you're speeding through Kansas on your way to Colorado at 90 miles an hour on the interstate. You have to be there, you have to walk it and feel it. And so doing that and setting books there and experiencing that environment, yeah, that helped make it possible to create this book.
Hi. As a writer myself, working on my first novel, you know, all we hear about is traditional publishing is getting harder and harder. Any advice for kind of breaking through that?
Well, I think traditional publishing is getting harder and harder because they are conglomerates now. You know, Rupert Murdoch signs my paycheck. So he doesn't care if I sell one book or 1,000 books, it's just a blip on his screen. But having said that, there are many, many small presses, regional presses, and even in the big conglomerates, smaller, more, I guess you could say, art-oriented imprints. I think, well, I mean, my own agent says that it has never been easier to get a first book published. It is harder to get a second book published because the floor gets raised on, when I started, I'm lucky to be so old and having been writing for so long. When I started, my first book sold 2,500 copies, and that was enough that the publisher wanted a second book. Now, for a lot of companies, Simon & Schuster particularly, the floor is 25,000, not 2,500. And getting those numbers, you know, I not hit those numbers anymore because of all the different ways that books are marketed. I am here to tell you that if you buy your books from Amazon, Tinkerbell just died. They control 65% of all the books sold in this country in all formats. They do deals that cripple writers, really cripple publishers, although the publishers are complicit in having given Amazon the power that they have. It's your independent bookseller who is bringing your book, your first book, your beloved book, to readers everywhere. And I don't know if it matters that much that you save the money that you save buying from Amazon. Go to your library. Your library will have that book. I am always, people come up to me at signing, sorry, now I'm on my soapbox, saying, I'm sorry, but I can't afford books, or I don't have room for books. I get mine out of the library. And I'm like, you go. You know, libraries are the most important market for all books, all writers. And if libraries stopped buying our books, we would all be dead. So you go to that library, you buy, you check that book out. Yeah.
So true.
I was wondering, especially with like the rise of crime media in general, and I was wondering why you think that so much crime appeals so much to women, as like, I know one of your podcasts has like 95% of their listeners are women, and why do you think that is?
Oh God, why do I think that crime and violent crime appeals more to women than to men? I don't know, but I have a theory that you can challenge and test or come up with an alternative, better theory. I think reading about danger has a sort of a totemic power to it. You're experiencing it vicariously, and so it gives you some protection against having to experience it personally. I was told once that 60% or 70% of the buyers of books about serial killers are women. And I thought, no, not me. I mean, I'm not in that demographic, but apparently there is some way in which you can keep danger at a distance by reading about it. Maybe, I don't know. That's just my theory. That's the only theory I have, but I'm open to additional theories that would expand how I'm thinking.
Well, I think maybe it's transference of your own anger. You're not gonna do these things, but someone else is.
Well, that's a great theory, actually.
That's what I think.
Yeah, I don't have power, but I'm gonna, yeah.
Someone's going to.
I love that.
Well, I just wanted to thank you both. Thank you, Donna, and thank you, Sarah. So can you all help us thank our panelists tonight?
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Be sure to subscribe so you are notified when new episodes are released. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.